You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, political junkie Ken Rudin puts today's political news in perspective, including the latest on the Republican reaction to Donald Trump as the last candidate standing. That's tonight at 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, when it comes to success in school, in a career, in a sport, talent can go a long way. But it's not always enough. Often there's that turning point where things get tough and we have to decide, do we bail out or do we stick it out and keep plugging away?
Our next guest says that's a big part of success or failure, and a lot of times it comes down to perseverance, determination, and in a word, grit. And she shares her research on grit in her new book.
Angela Duckworth joins us now. She's a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's author of the new book, Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this idea of grit, I think, conjures up something in everybody's mind, but can you put a definition on it? What is grit?
I think what it might conjure up in your mind is perseverance and hard work, resilience in the face of adversity. And I would half agree with you because perseverance is half of grit. But the other half of grit is just as important, and that is having a genuine passion, a genuine love for and sense of importance about a long-term goal.
And to get into the importance of it, you measured the grit of West Point cadets. Now, they're going through a challenging experience here. And you looked at whether they dropped out or stayed in and completed their training. And then you compared your grit measurements to the aptitude test that West Point itself did. So how important a predictor of success at West Point was grit?
That first summer of training, the summer that you're turned from a, you know, soft and squishy 18-year-old civilian into a future soldier and military leader, is affectionately known as Beast, even in official West Point literature. Beast, because it's that hard. And you're right, every year, even though these young men and women are highly selected for their physical aptitude, their intellectual capacity, etc., there are more cadets that drop out than people might imagine. And what I found is that your grit score, which is how you score on a simple questionnaire of how much passion and perseverance you tend to have for long-term goals, your grit score is a resoundingly accurate predictor of whether you're going to make it through Beast. And in comparison, what West Point calls their whole candidate score, a kind of composite of your various aptitudes, including physical and intellectual, that ends up not predicting at all who's going to make it through Beast.
It seems a little counterintuitive because you might think if someone's good at a thing, whether it's getting ready to be a soldier or music or math or whatever, if they've got that raw talent, they're going to coast on through no problem. But what I'm hearing you say is no, that's just not enough.
Well, I've always been surprised a little bit, I guess, by this finding that talent doesn't make it easier for you to stick with things, because after all, if you are more talented, you get so much out of all the time that you spend doing something. It turns out that talent is no protection against quitting things early, and it's also no guarantee that you'll really work on your weaknesses, continually work to improve in what you do.
So grit, you've talked about measuring it. How do we measure this really intangible property?
One way I've measured grit is through this grit scale that I mentioned. I can say a little bit about how it came to be. I was doing interviews with really high achievers. I mean, think of them as super achievers in fields as diverse as art and politics and music, commerce. This is early on in my study of grit. And almost verbatim, I actually translated the things that those super achievers would tell me about the people that they most admired into the grit scale. Now, people also, by the way, mentioned talent, luck, an opportunity, but I was not measuring those in my grit scale. That's to say that these other factors are, in fact, important. But the questions that I have on the scale, like I finish whatever I begin, I'm a hard worker, and questions about the consistency of interest over time, they really come from those interviews. A lot of my research is based on that questionnaire.
We're talking to Angela Duckworth. Her new book is Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. Well, I want to break down those two parts of grit. You mentioned earlier, part of it is the perseverance. What is it that determines if somebody has that quality? They encounter obstacles, they don't give up, they keep going.
You know, for about 50 years, there's been a growing science of what you could call resilience or what you could also call hope. And it tells us this, that when people give up things, it's often because they believe at some very deep level that they simply can't be successful. And if you don't think that you're going to be successful at something, then, of course, it's rational to give up. Now, the question is, why are some people optimistic about what they can do in a situation and other people pessimistic about what they can do? If you then trace back the roots of optimism and pessimism, you often find that people are carrying around in their heads these kind of private theories about the way the world works, so, you know, theories of human nature. Some people have a growth mindset. Deep down, they believe that abilities, people's natures can change and grow. Other people have a fixed mindset. They might believe that your abilities, your talents, who you are, your personality, it's pretty much fixed. You know, you can't change, a, you know, old dog, teach them new tricks. So what we find in our research is that people who are gritty tend to have a growth mindset, not a fixed one, and they're the ones who think optimistically about adversity.
Well, I wonder if you can change from one to the other. Because if you're in that camp that says we're fixed, we can't change, step one is you'd have to persuade them that they can change to that more growth-oriented perspective. Can it be done?
It can. I think it's really important to point out that these theories kind of reinforce themselves. You know, Henry Ford is often quoted as saying, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. You always prove yourself right, particularly, for example, if you have a fixed mindset and you're a pessimist, you might say, well, there's really nothing I can do here, so I'm not going to try, and it's going to end in failure. And then that's exactly what happens, which is that you don't try, and you fail, and you prove yourself right. Alternatively, if you have a growth mindset, you think, you know, there's something I can do here. Maybe I can change. Maybe my abilities in this domain, math, for example, basketball, whatever it is that you're trying, maybe I can grow. Then you put forth some effort and you show yourself that, in fact, change is possible. The question is, how do you move someone from a fixed mindset to a growth one? And what my colleague Carol Dweck, who really takes the credit for creating this science of growth mindset, she's a psychologist at Stanford University, and we collaborate, we talk. What we found together in our own data is that, yes, growth mindset leads to grit, but what she's found in her intervention research is that you can change a mindset, in particular, by essentially proving to people that the truth is that human nature is malleable. She does this by showing you pictures of neurons growing, making new synaptic connections. Those things are scientific facts, and she's very persuasive about explaining how, yes, you might start off with a fixed mindset, but once you discover these new truths, you can be convincing of yourself that it's worthwhile considering a growth mindset.
So we can persuade people to believe that their brains can change by showing them images of brains changing.
You know, that's part of it. But if you actually look at her interventions, there's also persuasive quotes. For example, you know, she'll get testimonials from, say, second-year college students who say to the first-year college students, you know, when I first got to college, I thought, you know, I'm never going to get the hang of this. There are people who are meant to be here and people who aren't. But I, you know, learned from my own experience that I was wrong about that. And when I started trying, you know, dot, dot, dot. So it's not just pictures of brains. It's testimonials and other things that, you know, but more than 50 years of psychological science has proven to be effective. And there's a lot of kind of technical, psychological expertise that goes into making these interventions as effective, as potent as they really are.
We've been talking about the perseverance side of the equation, that half of grit. Let's get to the other side, the passion and the purpose. A lot of times you hear the advice, do what you love for a career, which isn't always possible, but we can kind of meet that halfway, it sounds like, to find purpose. How do we do that?
You know, I've never been to a commencement speech, I think, that didn't have something along the lines of follow your passion, do what you love. This is probably because most of the people who stand up at the podium at commencement speeches are themselves incredibly successful, and it is certainly true that those individuals do love what they do. In fact, they use those exact words, I love what I do. Now, if you don't have something that you love, what's your situation? What advice do we have for you? I think the first thing to recognize is that these passions typically develop over time. I mean, if you look at Julia Child as just one example, she says in her autobiography that for much of her life, she had, quote, zero interest in the stove, unquote. Now, how did it happen that Julia figured out finally that she wanted to become a cookbook author? Well, it took time. She moved to France with her husband, at that early point, she didn't know whether she was going to end up in cooking at all. They had a few terrific meals at French restaurants that led to more terrific meals at bistros and cafes. She started wandering around the streets of Paris, seeing the beautiful produce and the wonderful bread. She decided that she would start to read about cooking. She got a cookbook from a friend. Her husband bought her a second one. That led to classes. Those classes led to more classes. One really important thing to realize about how most people figure out their passion is that it's a process of active discovery, and it really does take time.
We're talking to Angela Duckworth about her new book. It's called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Do you think hard work and perseverance are more important than talent? Did you get through an experience at work, maybe in school and sports and the military, by sticking with it even when you wanted to give up? And do you have questions about how to learn or to teach grit? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Angela Duckworth about her new book called Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How important is grit, resilience, stick-to-itiveness? Has it been a part of your life? Did someone maybe teach you a lesson in determination that stuck with you to this day? And how did you find a purpose to go along with that perseverance? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. Christopher is with us in Verona. Christopher, hi.
Hi, how are you? I have a question about kind of like the dark side. How do you know when to stop being persistent, when this grit isn't working? Like, I just feel like I went to graduate school, it didn't work out the first time, I came back, did it again, I finally got it, but in the process I also got burned out, and now I don't want to do it anymore. in my field of study. So I'm wondering, like, how do you know the difference between when it's time to quit and when is it really just a matter of being a little more persistent?
Great question, Christopher. What is it, grit? What is it, beating your head against the wall, Angela?
It is a great question, and not an easy one ever to personally negotiate, right? But here's some general advice. You know, I'd ask you why you went to graduate school, and the reason I start that question with why is that when you ask yourself why questions, you essentially go a level up in your goal hierarchy. When you ask yourself how, you go down a level. And by that goal hierarchy, this is what I mean. All of us have things that we want to do, but you can organize these things in levels. When you talk about high-level goals, they're kind of the ultimate whys. You know, like, I go to graduate school because I really care about psychology and I want to help people through psychology. Okay, in that case, are there other ways that you could help people through psychology other than that particular PhD program, if that's what you were in? I think by going up a level to the, why am I doing this anyway, it gives us a little bit of perspective. It allows for some flexibility in decision-making. Sometimes when we go up a level, we really realize that lower order goal isn't the only way that we can achieve what we're really after.
Christopher, thanks for that call. And Angela, that really illustrates your point that grit isn't just the perseverance side that we think of. It's the perseverance plus that passion or purpose.
Yeah, and when I talk about really mature paragons of grit, I call them real exemplars of passion and perseverance. You know, they really do have these top-level goals that give meaning to everything else that they do. It's the top-level goal. For me, I'll give you my example, use psychological science to help kids thrive. That top-level goal is something that I intend never to revise, but the lower-level goals that help me get there, I can be very flexible about.
And one of the ways you've done that in your career is you were a teacher for a while, and that leads me to something I definitely wanted to ask you. How can we cultivate, teach grit for kids?
I'm still figuring that out, and I don't want to tell people that I have all the answers. There is no grit curriculum, you know, click here, you know, 4 easy steps to make your classroom into a grit classroom. I wish I had those answers, but I don't. What I can say is that knowing the science, you know, knowing that interests take years to develop, knowing that interests tend to precede the kind of disciplined, deliberate practice that really makes you better at any skill, knowing that purpose, having a sense of meaning, and understanding what that really means psychologically. I think that all of these insights can inform classroom practice. If I were still in the classroom teaching math, which is what my subject area was, I would love to know those things so that when I went in there on Monday morning, I'd be able to say things differently. When I graded the test, maybe, you know, phrase my feedback very carefully. When I put up homework assignments, maybe give kids an idea of how when they went to study, they could be more effective. We're a really long way from having the answers all laid out from us, but I do think we're already at the point scientifically where we can at least inform educators about what we think is helpful and what we think is not.
Go back to our callers now with Jenny on the line in Milwaukee. Jenny, hi.
Hi. I was wondering, what do I do to get to, I'm kind of in between the two ends, but more towards the getting it done and accomplishing, but I stop short of that for many different things. And how do I push myself to accomplishing the goal or the certification or whatever it is? I don't know why, if it's because fear of what do I do, what happens next, or, you know, people find out that I feel sometimes that people might find out that I don't know what I'm doing. How do I get to pushing to the point of feeling good about doing it and finishing?
Jenny, thanks a lot for that call. Angela, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a terrific question. I have a lot of empathy for it because, you know, we've all been there, really. We really all have. You know, one of the things that's a resonant theme when I speak to coaches, and I'm talking about coaches who are coaching world-class athletes, you know, Olympic athletes or professional football league, professional basketball, NBA, you know, that one of the themes that comes out when you talk to coaches or CEOs, you know, it's that the really valuable thing to remember in all of this is that mistakes provide information. You know, when you say the wrong thing, when you screw up, when you give a PowerPoint presentation and nobody can read your slides, that's information. That failure carries lots of valuable information. By the way, when you're successful, when you give a great PowerPoint presentation or you say the right thing, that's also information, and you can learn from that too. What you have to do is realize that whether you succeed or whether you fail, there's something to be learned. And rather than worry that you're a loser or just hope that you're a winner, be confident that you're always a learner. And maybe that's more important than anything at all.
Thanks a lot for your call, Jenny. Good luck to you. We're talking to Angela Duckworth. Her new book is Grit, The Power of Passion and Perseverance. We'll go to another caller now at 800-642-1234 with Tucker on the line in Madison. Tucker, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
I heard your speaker talk about her top-level goal of helping children through psychology. And I'm graduating from college next year, and I wondered when she discovered that that was her top-level goal. And the reason I ask is because I think I've sort of discovered something that I intend to spend the next many years working on, but I've thought that 10 times in the last few years.
It is quite, let me reassure you that it is quite typical that in your 20s, there's a lot of experimentation and there's a lot of quitting, frankly, as you figure out what you ultimately want to stick with. I didn't go to graduate school for psychology until I was 32. That, by the way, was not my plan. I would have loved to have gotten started earlier, but I really didn't know that that was my direction. I took a while to figure out that, yes, I cared about kids, but no, I didn't want to play the role of the master teacher in their life. Though I, of course, myself benefited personally from having master teachers. I at one point thought I wanted to be a school principal and then decided I didn't want to do that. At one point I thought it would be through running a nonprofit. Nope, wasn't that either. So it took me a lot of years of kind of experimenting, figuring out what didn't work. But I think here's the thing to keep in mind. It's a little bit like dating, or at least for me. You know, I dated a lot of guys before I married my husband. As soon as I figured out that we weren't going to get married, I dropped the boyfriend. I was like, okay, done, I'm moving on. I was kind of dating with the intention of finding someone with whom I could settle down for life. And I think in terms of finding your calling, it's a little bit the same way. So don't be afraid to quit, but if you're merely quitting one thing, going to the next, without any intention of finding a calling, well, then I think you're never going to do that.
Thanks a lot for the call, Tucker. I wanted to ask, at one point in the book, you say grit can help us be successful on a career path. Can you also talk about happiness, though? What's the relationship between grit and happiness?
I find in my data that the grittier you are, also the more satisfied you are with your life and the more positive emotion you are. So for short, I could say the grittier you are, on average, the happier you are. But I want to point out that happiness and grit are not the same exact thing. I mean, in theory, you could be gritty and unhappy, or the converse. I just want to say that in my data, you don't see this huge trade-off where, you know, really gritty people are accomplished but miserable. I also want to say that it's not that success and grit are the only important things to worry about in life. I think leading a life of integrity, of moral standards that you really believe in, having relationships with your family and friends, I mean, these things are separate from our objective achievements, but for many people, they're more important. I've got two girls at home, one's 13 and one's 14, and if I were forced to decide between them being gritty or good, I would absolutely pick good.
We'll leave it there. Angela, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Angela Duckworth. She's professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Grit, The Power and Passion of Perseverance. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. A recent survey by the Daily Mail found that 82% of Britons frequently mispronounce words. Common examples include espresso for espresso and prescription for prescription.
The British have some company in this country where anyone who speaks any language will tell you, hey, words get mispronounced all the time. In fact, that's part of the package deal with languages, according to our next guest, who says being a stickler for correct pronunciation can be a form of snobbery, maybe even shorthand for race or class bias. That said, it's always fun to talk about language and what we might be getting wrong and right, including pronouncing language on the airwaves.
Oh, well. Well, Martha Barnett is with us now. She does not judge you, Rob. She's the co-host of the public radio show Away With Words. Martha, welcome back.
Hi, y'all. Good to be here.
So, Martha, does it matter if we're mispronouncing a word or not?
Great question. I will tell you that pronunciation is intensely personal. And I cannot tell you the number of times that people have called our radio show and talked about a pronunciation that they said just made their skin crawl or felt like fingernails on a chalkboard. But you're right. The thing that you said in your introduction about the fact that sometimes pronunciation just reflects where we come from and how we were raised. And I think the real key to getting exercise about pronunciation is if it messes up your spelling.
So that's the key. If the way we pronounce it makes us then turn and spell something wrong, that's when people should get worried?
Yeah, I think so. Otherwise, a lot of pronunciation is pretty subjective, and a lot of it is changing all the time. I was reading an article, in fact, the other day about pronunciation, and it was saying that a lot of us make a mistake when we pronounce some word or other. I don't remember what it was, but what they said was the E-R-R. The word was E-R-R. Now, how do you guys pronounce it?
I err in the pronunciation,
err. Uh-huh.
I try not to say because I'm never sure how to pronounce that one.
Yeah,
I talk around it. To err, right?
Exactly.
To err is human.
Yeah. You say err?
I guess so, if I had to.
I do too. But guess what? I wasn't sure of myself either. And even as I was thinking about it, I just couldn't remember if it was err or err. And I looked it up in a number of manuals. And do you know that linguistic authorities are still holding on to that? To err is human?
Huh.
I did not know that.
You would think it would be like error or errant. But no, the traditional pronunciation for a long time was err. And you know, William Safire once said that when enough of us say it wrong, we'll be right. And more of us are saying it as air, and I imagine that in another generation it will be air. But, you know, that's just a perfect example of someplace where I got tripped up.
Well, right, that's the classic example of what language does, isn't it? It's fluid, and if enough people say it maybe incorrectly, then the common speak changes, and that's the right way.
Exactly. And you know, the example I gave of spelling was reflected, wasn't it last week that there, did you all read about this, that Tracy McCreary, a state mm-hmm. representative in Missouri, introduced a bill? You read about this?
I did, yeah. She did, her colleagues in the legislature were saying fiscal incorrectly.
Yes, they were saying physical when they were supposed to say fiscal. And I can see where that would possibly lead to a problem with spelling. Of course, the funny thing is that, you know, I said that she's a state representative in Missouri, but I'm sure that there are Missouri people who would get on me for not saying Missouri.
Well, now, some of the words we mispronounce, a lot of us do the same thing, and maybe it's going to change over time. But it seems like there's a whole other category where there's the unique ones. And I think I've mentioned this one to you before, where for years I had read the word ancient and locked in my head that this is a word you say, ancient. And that's just flat out wrong. There was no, it's not like, that's not a gray area. A lot of us have our own little unique words that we just say wrong, right?
Right. Right. And if you think about it, I mean, pronunciation is a habit, right? We learn it really, really early. And sometimes we work to learn a pronunciation. And then when we hear somebody else pronounce it some different way, then we think, what? How could that possibly be? They're wrong. And they aren't necessarily, but in your case, you are.
And I want to be tolerant, Martha. I really do. But can you correct Rob on something for
Uh-oh.
Me?
I know where this is going.
How does it begin this way? I want to be tolerant.
But how would you pronounce the name of the Beatle
who played
the drums?
The first name.
The Beatle who plays the drums, you mean Ringo Starr?
Correct. I would certainly say it was
right.
Ringo Starr.
And I say Ringo, too, just like everybody else. See,
Ringo. Do you really?
I think it's such a subtle point that I don't hit the G hard enough that I wonder at one who would make a big deal about it.
So what are those four things on your hands?
Rings. Not rings.
Well, what are wearing the rings?
Ring what? My fingers.
Oh, not fingers?
Fingers. Okay. Okay. I wonder why you say Ringo. I've never heard that one. But I'm fascinated that you do.
Huh. I'm not convinced I'm wrong.
Fascinating. She's being kind.
Yeah. We're talking about mispronunciations and gray areas that are acceptable in many ways with Martha Barnett from the radio show Away With Words. You can hear her, by the way, Sunday mornings at 9 here on the Ideas Network. So we mentioned, you say this can be sometimes over-focusing on pronunciation could be a shorthand for maybe some kind of prejudice, Martha.
Well, sure. We just grow up with these preoccupations about this or that pronunciation. And, I mean, think about the word et cetera. I mean, some people say, it's two words, right? Et cetera. Some people say et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I can see where people could get snobby about that one because they're not realizing, apparently, that et cetera is actually two Latin words that literally mean and the rest. And so, yeah, it's to some degree, sometimes pronunciations can be a badge of education, but you sure as heck better make sure that you have it correct if you're going to correct somebody. There's something called Hartman's Law of Prescriptivist Retaliation. Mm-hmm. Have you heard of this one?
No.
Mm-mm.
It goes, any article or statement about correct grammar, punctuation, or spelling is bound to contain at least one error. And that holds true for pronunciation as well. I can't tell you the number of times we get emails from people who are exercised about this or that mispronunciation, but In the message header, it will say grammar spelled with an E rather than a final A. So you've got to be careful when you're correcting people.
Well, Martha, you sent us a list of your top 10 or so, and on your list was the word M-O-O-T. What are you hearing people do with that one?
Moot, as in a moot point. A lot of people are saying a moot point, which sort of makes sense. Mm. If you're talking about a moot point, you're talking about something that is hypothetical. And that one, too, might be a measure of education, because a moot point is a hypothetical point of discussion that's used as a teaching exercise for law students, and it goes back to in England, M-O-O-T, moot, was an assembly of people, and so you can see how that would lead to the notion of people discussing things and arguing. But some people say a mute point, meaning a silent point. And you can sort of see how that makes sense, but that is incorrect. And the other one that's not correct along those lines is moo point. I don't know if you're a fan of Friends, but on the show Friends, Joey talks about a moo point.
I missed that one.
That's very relevant in Wisconsin, definitely.
right, I guess so.
Well, one word on your list that I sometimes steer clear of, and it's in this category of things that look like they should be maybe pronounced in a French way, is, am I standing in a foyer or a foyer?
Mm. Yeah, I just heard of that on a TV show last night. Foyer or foyer, I just say lobby or something like that, because that's one of those words that we refer to as a skunked word, because either way you pronounce it, somebody is going to have a problem with it. The best pronunciation supposedly is foyer and not foyer, which sounds more affected, supposedly.
And let's
like you said, Veronica, sometimes I just try to word my way around things like that, because as I said, terms like foyer or fort instead of forte, they, you know, people, you're going to offend somebody.
Well, another one of your words, Martha, was P-U-N-D-I-T. Tell us about that one.
Yes. Pundit, and more, especially in this election year, I'm hearing people say pundit.
Pundit.
You've heard that one?
I don't know if I've heard that much.
Just from Rob.
Huh?
No, not really.
I just heard somebody say it last night on TV, because I'm following the elections, and somebody said pundit. You know who says pundit? Listen to Bernie Sanders.
Huh.
Bernie Sanders is pundit. He sticks an N in there between the I and the T, and it's not in there. And I don't know how he spells it, but he pronounces it in a way that's non-standard, pundit. It goes back to a Sanskrit word, pandit, which means a learned man.
Well, that's an interesting one. Maybe we'll have to tweet at Bernie Sanders and correct his pronunciation. Or maybe not.
I don't know about that.
We'll say Martha Barnett says.
I mean, plenty of people say it. Mm-hmm.
Martha Barnett is with us now. We're talking about words that we mispronounce. She's the co-host of the public radio show, Away with Words.
She's the pundit when it comes to language. And we want to hear from you. What word do you wonder if you're pronouncing correctly? Does it bug you when you hear people mispronounce words? What's your vote for most frequently mispronounced word? Have you said a word? Have you gotten it wrong before and maybe corrected other people only to be recorrected yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're back with Martha Barnett, co-host of the public radio show Away with Words. And we're talking about which words we mispronounce the most often and whether or not it's actually even worth caring about.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Which word do you hear mispronounced most often? Do you correct people? Should we correct people? What words do you have trouble with? Which ones do you stumble over? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now with Roxy in Luxembourg. Roxy, hi.
Hi there. My family corrects me or mocks me. And is it an all-you-can-eat buffet or is it all-you-can-eat buffet? Buffet or buffet?
Buffet or buffet?
Buffet. What do you say?
Which side are you on, Roxy?
I don't know. I guess I usually say, oh, it's a buffet.
So, but do you know people who say buffet?
Yeah.
Huh. That's not one I've encountered, Roxy. Martha, is that one you've run into?
I said it that way growing up, buffet, and oh. I think I got it from my mother, and I think she was thinking it was sort of Frenchified, and that's why she said it that way. But in American English, it's buffet.
I wonder, I mean, because you could be Martha Barnett and I could be Rob Ferret if people overdid this Frenchifying thing.
I like
that's
those.
That's true. Originally, I didn't have an E on the end of my name, but when my hillbilly family moved from the mountains to the town, my Aunt Mazo added an E just to look Frenchified.
Well, you could also be Martha Barnetti.
I could.
Slight twist on that.
Before,
all right, Roxy, thanks a lot for that. We're going to go next to Tina in Lake Geneva. Tina, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks
for putting me on the air. I say we definitely correct people. Is the only thing that separates us from the animal kingdom is our ability to perfect our speech. It is buffet, and it is a grand foyer if you live in the South, and it's a foyer if you're in Arkansas.
Huh.
So a lot of it's colloquialism, but my pet peeve is people who make up words. I'm an educator. I hear other teachers that I work with say, look it to students.
Instead of look at.
Them, instead of look at. They say look it. Look it is not a word. It's nowhere in an English dictionary.
So they allied two words.
Yes.
I don't know. I might be inclined to take a lighter hand with that one, but I don't know. I'm not an educator. What do you think about that one, Martha?
I have heard that a lot in Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. I didn't hear it looking up. I'm sorry. I didn't hear it growing up in Kentucky, but... I'm looking in the Dictionary of American Regional English based there in Madison, mm-hmm. and it looks like it's sometimes pronounced look it, mm-hmm. indeed. So I would say it's a regional expression.
That's an interesting one.
It's not excruciatingly correct standard English. And you know what? I do have to apologize to your caller before, because I have found buffet in the American Heritage Dictionary as we're sitting here. I'm not seeing it in others, but that sort of proves our point, doesn't it? That you can't always take one dictionary at its word, because
right.
different dictionaries say different things about pronunciation. So I would say go to the buffet and bon appetit.
Well, I'm just going to give up then, I think. We'll go back to our callers, though. We've got James on the line in Madison. James, hi.
Hi, guys. Great show. Thanks for sharing. So I explained, this is technically my brother's story, but since he lives out of state, I'm taking license of sharing on his behalf. I recall him telling me when he was in high school, I believe it was his English class, they encountered the phrase faux pas, which, having not heard before, he pronounced fox pas. And his snooty classmate quickly rebutted him, saying, oh, you mean faux pas, with her nose held high in the air. So
James,
those French ones tend to get us.
Thanks for that. And, you know, that's one I probably mispronounced at some point in my life, because I, like a lot of words, probably read it before I heard it. Martha, this is more etiquette than language, but is there a right way, a nice way, a polite way to helpfully give the right pronunciation without, you know, being condescending about it?
Oh, you're absolutely right. I'm identifying with the time in fourth grade when I was trying to read a story to the class, and I was talking about a character named Penelope. And I finally got corrected. You know, somebody told me it was Penelope. But those kinds of moments can be absolutely humiliating. You're absolutely right. I mean, if you're going to correct somebody, we say this all the time on the show, if you're going to correct somebody, please, number one, make sure that you're right. And number two, do it in private. Take this person aside privately. And really, there's no reason to play gotcha. You can use it as the start of a conversation.
Well, thanks to James for that. And I actually say, yeah. I kind of like fox paws.
Yeah.
I think we should all start
saying
that. We're
going to try to make that a thing.
Let's make that a thing.
Yeah, kind of gingerly. Yeah.
It's a sort of mistake that make even the clever fox pause
uh-huh.
for a moment.
See? You can rationalize
good,
that
yeah.
one. All right, James, thanks so much for the call. And we're going to go next to Tim in Amherst. Tim, hello.
Hi. I have a question. I am a very bad speller. So if I can't spell a word, how am I supposed to know how to pronounce it?
Mm-hmm. Fair question, Martha.
Ooh, if you can't, yeah. I guess listen very carefully to how
how folks you admire and respect are pronouncing things. I completely identify. But I will tell you that one of the best writers I ever knew when I worked at the Louisville Courier Journal in Kentucky was the world's worst speller. So some of us just don't have that gift. But yeah, I would. I'm not sure I can offer advice for that.
We're talking about mispronounced words with Martha Barnett from the radio show Away With Words. Our next caller is Dave on the line in Madison. Dave, hi.
Hello. I've got one that I've noticed it for a number of years, and it's always, whenever I've heard it, it kind of grabbed me. I always say strength, the strength of a physical substance.
Uh-huh.
But I hear on the radio and hear other places where it's the strength of something.
Strength,
and I'd like to know if I'm just blowing that word or what.
The E changed a little, and this sounds like the G gets dropped there, Martha.
Yes, the G gets dropped, and it's like length. Some people say length, and it's sort of in that same family of words where some people say height instead of height. They add an H on the end of that, and it's not a standard pronunciation, and but you do hear it a lot.
Well, thanks so much for that call, and a quick one here. From Margaret in Wisconsin Rapids. Margaret, hi.
We have a difference of opinion in our family on how to pronounce coupon. Some of us say coupon and some say coupon.
Coupon.
And we don't know if that's a regional thing.
The correct answer is coupon.
You're turning everything French today, Rob. I don't know. What do you think, Martha?
Yeah, I'm looking in one dictionary and it says just coupon.
Really?
It does come from French, from coupé, meaning to cut. So that's probably why some people are saying coupon. But, that's one of those that can go either way. And that's one of the fun things to argue about, right?
Coupon or coupon? Well, clearly what we
I'm
need
a coupon
to do
guy,
is
yeah.
drop French
You're
words from
guy.
The language.
Yeah. One of my favorites is theater. I had a friend who said it theater. And I looked it up in a dictionary, and that was an allowable one. So maybe the lesson here, Martha, is we shouldn't lose too much sleep because most of the time both ways are right.
That's absolutely true. And, you can look up in different dictionaries, as I said. Some of them have different things. I mean, I'm looking at the American Heritage right now, and I don't see that pronunciation that you're mentioning. But I'm sure if I opened up something else, like the Dictionary of American Regional English based there in Madison, I'm sure I would see theater. I think the bottom line is that we have a lot of differences in pronunciation, and a lot of them are to be celebrated.
All right. That's a good place to leave it. Thanks to Martha Barnett from Away With Words. You can catch her Sunday mornings at 9 on the Ideas Network. Keep this mispronunciation conversation going on the Central Time Facebook page.